Case number 12-5201, National Security Archive Appellant versus Central Intelligence Agency. Mr. Kadeem for the appellant, Mr. Zeff for the appellee.
Good
morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Alon Kedem for Appellant National Security Archive. In a case under Exemption 5, an agency must, at a minimum, answer two basic questions. First, what policy or decision is at issue? And second, what information about that decision would be revealed if the requested document were disclosed? In this case, the agency has been unable to answer either question. First, Volume 5, the document requested in this case, is not pre-decisional because it is unconnected to any agency policy.
But you're assuming that we assess the pre-decisional or not character of a document with hindsight, while wherever you have a rule which is designed to encourage communication, the ordinary stance is to view it at the time the document is being created. I mean, that's why, for example, in the context of the lawyer-client privilege, the Supreme Court has held that for federal purposes, the death of the client is of no significance.
Your Honor, there are aspects of the characteristics of the document which are set at the time that it's created. On the other hand, it is the agency's burden in litigation to sustain its claim of privilege.
Would you agree that we have to look at it at the time the document is created? And if you don't agree with that, what's your basis?
Your Honor, there are certain aspects of the document which, again, are set at the time the document is created. For instance,
one of the things that's set at that time is the mind of the creator and what is or ought to be in that creator's mind. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in this case, that involved the anticipation that this would be go through a certain review process, and various things might happen to it in the review process, including that it might be spiked. But the thing that the Exemption 5 is aimed at is assuring that the author of a document in that situation is not induced to pull his punches.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the issue is not that Volume 5 was never finalized. The issue is that from the start, the agency never intended to publish or stand behind Volume 5 as an official expression of its views.
Just to help you out a little, too, the author doesn't control the privilege.
That's absolutely correct,
Your Honor. So the author never has the assurance, unlike, say, the attorney-client privilege.
That's correct.
In the government situation, you're hopeful that some superior will assert the privilege, but you never really know for sure.
That's correct. And it's important, again, to emphasize, Your Honor, that the agency never intended that Volume 5 or any of Dr. Pfeiffer's work would become public or would become, in any sense, an agency's stance. And it's for that reason.
That would be normally true of a pre-decisional document, right? The document itself would not be intended to go out to the public. It would be a preliminary to some agency action.
That's correct, Your Honor. But it's not merely that they never intended to publish the first draft. They never intended to publish even the final draft of what Dr. Pfeiffer did. And I would point you to page A39 of the record, in which it's made clear by Dr. McDonald, who was the supervisor to Dr. Pfeiffer, who made it very clear there was never any intention on the part of the agency that this would become a public history in any sense. And the agency has not claimed otherwise. Instead, it claims that even internal reference documents that are solely intended to be within the agency itself and never made public are somehow agency policies.
I'm not sure that how that helps you. I mean, suppose you have somebody working on a draft proposal, they know they're going to forward it to someone up the chain, and it's going to be, the only thing that's going to happen is an action. Like, if they have pigs, something is going to happen in the world, not a document is going to be released, but something will happen. The government will do something. So in those cases, there's no anticipation, whatever, of a document emerging on the scene that's still protected.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in that case, it's not because there's a publication, but because the document, which is never published, is connected to some future agency policy decision, stance,
well,
or action.
I thought the argument here was that the CIA thought there might be lessons to be learned. You hope there would be.
Sure.
Lessons to be learned from the whole experience, and that having an agency history, even if not disclosed beyond the agency, would help the agency avoid such errors.
Sure, Your Honor. Certainly it's useful in the very general sense that all agency documents memorializing past decisions or evaluating past decisions might be in a very useful sense, general sense useful. I would point you, though, to the case, among others, of Vaughn versus Rosen, which involved personnel reports, and they were evaluated, basically evaluating how different agency personnel managers were doing their jobs. And what this court said is, sure, these might be useful in some general sense, but they aren't necessarily used in contemplation of some further future agency action. And I would also point out that at the time that Dr. Pfeiffer started his work, it was more than 10 years after the Bay of Pigs. There was no intention to go reinvade Cuba at that time. And by the time he had finished work,
the United States confronts other hazards abroad.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But the agency in this case has not pointed to any future action that Dr. Pfeiffer's work was in contemplation of. And in fact, the argument they make is entirely irrespective of the content of Volume 5. They don't say, for instance, that the subject matter of Volume 5 was especially controversial. They don't say that publication of Volume 5 would disclose some sort of internal disagreement within the agency. Instead, they make a blanket claim, a categorical claim, that release of any draft history on any subject prior to its finalization automatically qualifies it both as being predecisional and deliberative.
Do you think histories like this are a good thing?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Do you think agencies will do them if we accept your position here?
I do, Your Honor.
Won't they be concerned about the drafts being completely unprotected?
Your Honor, there may be some concern, but I think the agency's allegation of harm in this case, and again, it's important to emphasize,
Put aside this case for a minute. I'm worried,
sure.
Concerned about, if we accept your position, how agencies will respond. I think the histories, which you acknowledge, I think correctly, common sense, are a good thing, would be a thing of the past in the sense that I think agencies would be, or not many people would be volunteering to write the first draft of those things, knowing what could happen in terms of public release and how that can be used against them.
Sure. 2 points, Your Honor. First of all, in many cases, histories will be written because the agency is in the process of rethinking or reevaluating some process, some specific decision, or even a general cluster of decisions, a particular topic. That's not what the agency has said in this case. And second, with respect to the CIA in particular, that agency, most of its histories are classified. And in fact, Volume 5 was initially classified in its entirety. Mm-hmm. It's only because of...
But this rule would apply to all agencies.
It would, Your Honor. It would. But, over time...
I take your point as the CIA histories.
Right. Yeah. CIA histories. Mm-hmm. But I do think in many cases, it will be the case that the agency can say, the reason we are writing this history is because we're in an ongoing process. And again, it doesn't necessarily have to culminate in a final decision, but there is usually some sort of process about making decisions in general that the document could be tied to.
Counsel, I noticed that in your summary, in your gray brief of Long versus Rosa, they're requiring the agency to disclose the factual portions of its personnel reports, but permitting agency to withhold the portions that provided advice and recommendations. It does seem to me that certainly, from what we know about Volume 5, it seems to involve advice and recommendations. It may also involve facts, but it seems certainly to involve advice and recommendations.
Your Honor, it may. We obviously haven't seen it. But the agency has not pointed to any specific recommendations or advice. It does say that there are certain opinions. So in the McDonald Declaration, again, McDonald says, Dr. McDonald.
Sometimes people give advice by expressing opinions.
Sometimes they do, Your Honor, but opinions and advice are not necessarily always the same thing. And again, given that Dr. Pfeiffer was writing up until the 1980s about an inspector general report, which itself was written in 1961.
Is it? Keep going. Sorry.
It seems a little bit hard to imagine that he was really providing that many specific opinions. But if he was, and the agency can identify them, that would be a basis for the agency to withhold certain portions, but it would not justify their blanket claim, which is the type of claim that they have here.
Yeah, history of agency action almost inherently is not going to be tied to any specific future decision, but could have, the whole idea of doing the history, I think, is to affect untold, unknown future decisions so people learn from the past. And doesn't your position, a history of the Washington administration still helping presidents today?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in that
But if there had been a FOIA request, you wouldn't know, it's going to 200 years from now still be helpful. But the kind of thing you're talking about here, and you want to get a good final product, you want to encourage agencies to do this, and disclosing the drafts may deter that.
Right? I see I'm running up into my rebuttal time. May I answer?
Mm-hmm.
Your Honor, it's true that all agency records are useful in that general sense. Otherwise, there would be, in many cases, no point in creating the records.
Mm-hmm.
But Exemption 5 is meant to be an exemption that specifically addresses pre-decisional deliberative material. And it's not enough simply to say, well, someone might get back to this at some point in the future.
Well, on a hit, yeah, I agree with you on stated that generally. You wouldn't want to broaden out the deliberative process privilege like that. But when you're talking about a history of agency action, it does seem to me that the whole purpose of that is to be a resource so future agency decision makers with any number of decisions don't repeat the mistakes of the past. And so in that sense, right, if it has to be a specific tied decision, you have a point, but I'm not sure history really fits well into that kind of box.
Your Honor, I would again point you to Vaughn versus Rosen, where there was no doubt that the purpose of the personnel reports was to be useful in in some general sense in the future, in much the same way that most agency records are useful.
All right. Thank you. Counsel for Appellee.
May it please the Court, the CIA has demonstrated through four declarations totaling 63 pages why, under the facts of this case, disclosure of a CIA staff historian's draft historical manuscript titled CIA's Internal Investigation of the Bay of Pigs is both pre-decisional and harmful to the agency's deliberative process and was therefore properly withheld under Exemption 5. First, the draft internal history is pre-decisional because it was submitted by a staff historian to his supervisors for inclusion in the CIA's official history of the Bay of Pigs, which was always intended for internal use, not public consumption, and is the agency's policy decision to which the draft history relates. Second, the CIA has explained how the release of Volume 5 would harm the deliberative process of the CIA's history staff. It would discourage current and future historians from taking positions that are unpopular or controversial within the agency, and the CIA has explained why this is true despite the passage of time since the failed Bay of Pigs operation in the 1960s.
Why doesn't it run out at some point? In other words, why not put an end date on protection for the deliberative process privilege?
Two reasons, Your Honor. The first is that, unlike the presidential records privilege or some of the other contacts that the appellant has cited, Congress didn't put a time limit in the FOIA. Second of all, though, in this case, which is what we're focused on, I think it would be helpful to answer the question by analogy. When the CIA director speaks with the President of the United States, he or she is the agency. He or she is speaking for the agency, is giving an official view of the agency.
I mean, I saw that in your brief. I understand in a certain sense, because it's obviously not a pre-decisional in the agency, but just in terms of the chilling effect, what's your distinction?
The distinction is that, unlike a president who can't serve for more than two terms, the CIA historians often serve for decades. Dr. Pfeiffer, in this case, worked for the CIA.
Well, some CIA directors have gone on.
That is true, Your Honor. But Dr. Pfeiffer,
we're at 30 years, and he's been dead for 16.
Yes, he also worked for the CIA for approximately 30 years. Mm. And so if the chilling effect, as Your Honor mentioned earlier, is that historians working on an internal agency history would be discouraged from taking unpopular or controversial positions.
Why aren't CIA directors, or I guess it's the DNI now, the president's daily brief, why are they not concerned about outsiders' later views of their advice? They are, aren't they?
I don't know that they're not concerned, Your Honor, but after their term is up, they will not be speaking anymore or taking any opinion on behalf of the agency.
Their successors will. I don't see how that helps you at all.
Yeah, they all write books.
I think, again, just looking back at the facts of this case, the agency has I think, very clearly explained that this is still an issue. If you work for an agency, your drafting history is for 20, 30, 40 years, and as I believe it was Judge Williams mentioned, if everything you suggest to a supervisor in relation to that history, which, by the way, is commissioned, in this case, it was asked to be drafted by a CIA deputy director, and if everything is going to be turned over, that harms the deliberative process.
The CIA director tomorrow could decide to release all draft histories, right?
There might be a few other bureaucratic rules,
put aside the classified issue, but in terms, or a director of an agency could do that anytime and say, we're going to release all the old draft histories, right?
Yes.
And as a government employee, you hope that the president, the agency head, will stand by the privilege at certain points, but you have no assurance of that. It's unlike the attorney-client situation where you, the person speaking, the client speaking to the attorney, controls the waiver of the privilege. You don't control it as the speaker. So the whole thing's built on a kind of faulty foundation.
What is Your Honor's question?
The question is, how you're relying a lot on the harm to the process because the person will be chilled, I believe, if I'm Yes. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And saying, well, I don't know how the privilege really works to do that because you don't control it in the first place. It's waived all the time by the agency head. So if it's trying to encourage the person doing the speaking or the writing, that really I'm not sure your analogy really works because you don't control the privilege, or your argument really works there because you don't control the privilege in the first place.
That's right, Your Honor. But the deliberative process is also, it's designed to protect the history staff's deliberative process in this case. So while it's true in Your Honor's example that the individual historian might not control the privilege, everybody involved in the multi-layered review of this process has a vested interest in that process. Mm-hmm. And that if every subordinate's views are automatically turned over, that sort of takes it away from the higher-ups that do determine what's released and what's not.
What about the idea that there's no specific decision that this is tied to?
I would point this court to its own decision in Russell versus Department of the Air Force. That's directly analogous. You have an Air Force history that the court said was properly withheld under Exemption 5. And the court had, this court had no problem saying that the official agency decision is the agency's own history.
Now, of course, appellants distinguished that case from this case for the reasons counsel just went into great detail about. So that may not exactly get you where you need to be here.
I think it does, though, Your Honor, because just like in Russell, and I'm pointing the court to pages 86 to 88 of the record, that's paragraphs 3 through 6 of the declaration of the CIA's current chief historian. In Russell, the court acknowledged that the primary considerations, that I'm quoting now from 1047 of Russell, the primary considerations are that the products have utility for direct mission support purposes and are of current and future value to the Air Force in planning and decision making. The CIA's current chief historian said the same thing about the CIA's history. They actually are drafted for internal use for direct mission support and for use among current and future CIA officers.
So, appellants are correct that you're seeking this very broad protection for drafts ad infinitum.
No, Your Honor. I'm merely suggesting that the facts of this case are very similar to the facts in Russell.
But the effect of that is, if you're correct, that drafts are exempt ad infinitum.
Not if they're not tied to a deliberative process.
Right, but a draft history is going to be protected forever, unless someone chooses to waive it.
Isn't that what you're arguing?
I think you can say yes to that.
Yeah,
I think you have to say yes to that.
Yes.
I think I do as well, Your Honor.
I don't know
whether
you can, but you have to. I think you.
Yes. Yeah.
In other words, appellants are arguing there never was any intent by the agency to use this as a history, at least as to Volume 5.
Well, that's...
And Russell emphasizes that the Air Force had a history, all right? So you're talking about something leading up to that history. That's why I'm saying Russell may not get you quite as far as you need to get. And you're resisting that, but I mean, those are the facts of Russell.
Yeah, just two quick responses. One, that's not exactly, appellant's statement is not true under the record of this case. The first few declarations given by former Chief Historian McDonald indicated that there was a possibility that it was still under review. But second of all, with respect to Russell, the fact that it wasn't ultimately published is irrelevant for this analysis.
All right, but Russell doesn't get you there. That's all I'm... You were saying Russell was dispositive. Is that correct?
No, I was saying it was analogous, Your Honor.
Analogous. All right. So the other argument made is that looking at our court and the three purposes of the privilege, the agency's already disclosed everything. It's disclosed why it turned down the report. It disclosed that it's not going to use this report for history. It's disclosed, and our cases have disclosed, that it has this review process. And this is not a case where there's any claim that there is a national security material that's at stake here. The agency has publicly said it disagrees with this document. It doesn't represent the agency's policy. They were highly critical of it. And there's nothing to indicate that they intend to use it in any way, because it said they're highly critical of it. And two historians so far, at least, have rejected it.
A couple of responses to that. If Your Honor is suggesting, I just want to make sure I'm responding to your question.
Mm-hmm.
In the appendix, A62 through 64
mm-hmm.
is a very detailed description of why Volume 4, which is the Taylor Committee Report, which is essentially a factual summary of that external body's report, is significantly different
mm-hmm.
from Volume 5. So it's not a situation where...
No, but we know why Dr. McDonald rejected the draft.
We actually...
I mean, that's public.
We only know in general terms. If Your Honor...
Well, we know what he's told us and what is in the public realm.
And to that, I would say I would refer the court to Me Data,
mm-hmm.
the very case that appellant relies on significantly, which is that the CIA is under... It would defeat the purpose of the privilege if you disclosed everything as to why you're claiming the privilege. So the references to it contain a polemic of recriminations, those are just general terms, a general description of why the CIA rejected Volume 5. But if the court looks in the record, and I will get a cite in a second, there's a statement by former Chief Historian McDonald, there were a lot of edits, a lot of other reasons, more detailed reasons as to why it was rejected.
Right. So, I mean...
That have not been released to the public.
That's right, but there's... And we don't know what the draft says either in
Correct.
Terms of substance. But I'm just looking at the three reasons this court in its in-bank case said were the purposes of the privilege. And you're arguing that these drafts can never be released unless there's a waiver by the CIA director or someone with that authority. So we've said, you know, releasing it could lead to confusion, but there's not going to be any confusion because the agency isn't adopting this position, hasn't ever published this. And Judge Kavanaugh has reviewed with you the concerns about chilling, and we already know the inner workings. So the only thing we don't know is what the draft says as a matter of substance.
A couple of responses, if I may, Your Honor. First of all, just to clarify, the government is not arguing that this can never be released. The government's arguing...
It can be waived. I understand that.
But the government's also stating that...
On the facts
right
of
now,
this case, yes.
Right now, not basically... The passage of time still hasn't made it releasable.
Government will be arguing that 50 years.
I can't predict.
There's nothing in your brief that would suggest years are going to make any difference. That's my point. It's not as though, you know, your brief isn't written that way.
Well, my only response to that, Your Honor, is just as a matter of fact, that volumes 1 through 4 are on the CIA's website. So those were initially not released. They have since been, and Volume 5 has been reviewed several times over the last 30 years, and it still has not been released for the reasons stated in the CIA's declaration. But
1 through 4 were released by the voluntarily, right?
After the FOIA.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so how does that respond?
Can you clarify the question one more time, Your Honor?
Well, I went over the 3 purposes that we have identified for the privilege.
As far as confusion to the public, I would point the court to page 92 through 94 of the appendix, where the CIA attempts to explain why release of this would confuse the public.
About what?
About whether Dr. Pfeiffer's draft historical manuscript is an official statement of the CIA.
Is that not confusing? I mean, we know that the 2 historians have rejected it. I mean, that's not going to be confusing, is it?
I think, for the reasons stated in the declarations, the public tends to view agency documents as official agency views.
A draft expressing an employee's personal views all of a sudden becomes the agency's official policy when it's released?
No, but it also doesn't say on there that this is the personal views
of the
drafter.
And the CI director makes it perfectly clear, this is not our policy, we've never adopted it, this is Dr. Pfeiffer's personal views.
And again, I...
So that's the only confusion that you think is relevant here, whether release would lead the public to think this is the CIA's official explanation.
Yes, that's what's stated in the declarations.
Right.
And then the second reason being the chilling.
And you understand the reasons that I find that not totally persuasive.
I do.
And so what's your response?
My response is, if Your Honor does not find that persuasive, I think the reasons the CIA has given for why it would also chill frank communications within its history staff, hopefully Your Honor would find persuasive.
All right. So the chilling is what Judge Kavanaugh was discussing with you.
Yes.
And you came back with, it's not the individual staff person, it's the relationship between the historians?
The whole drafting history process, the whole process of the agency's history staff, yes.
I understand it in terms of an individual, but I'm not clear about the process.
Well,
in other words, there are 3 historians. One has a wild view, one has a moderate view, and one has basically is towing the agency line. What are we concerned about chilling?
We're concerned about the way, just like the Air Force and Russell, we're concerned about the entire deliberative process within an agency, how the agency comes about completing its own internal histories. And the agencies, both the Air Force and in this case the CIA, set up multi-layer review processes.
But I want to be just clear. Every agency has a review process. It's multi-layered, normally. In the public, we already know what the process was back then. It may have changed now, but that's no surprise to anybody. I mean, that's not what the deliberative process is trying to get at. I mean, that I draft something, that you as my supervisor review it, and that your supervisor reviews it, and it goes back and forth?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, the cases make fairly clear that it's trying to protect the agency's decision-making process.
And encourage candor.
And encourage candor, yes.
That's the big thing.
Absolutely.
So it's the substantive part of the process. It's not the process itself. In other words, it's the fact that you told me you didn't like Part 5, so I changed Part 5. Then you told me it still wasn't good enough, so I changed it again. then you say it's okay, but then your supervisor has a problem with it. So it's that substantive concern. Whereas
yes.
Here, Dr. McDonald has at least told us in part what his substantive concerns were. And it didn't go any further than Dr.
McDonald. In general
McDonald.
Terms, that's right.
Well, in pretty specific terms. Polemics against CIA.
And I'm just
all right.
responding to that, Your Honor, that those are general terms. And if you look at McDonald's declaration, he gives enough explanation to invoke the privilege, but not so much that it renders the privilege irrelevant.
Do you think you have to show harm in the particular case?
If Your Honor is asking about McKinley, it's the government's position that that no, harm is not a new separate element, but however the court reads McKinley, it's been done in this case.
Mm-hmm. So the government, okay, I think you answered it.
All right. If there are...
And so to the extent, I know you distinguish the statutory schemes, but to the extent Congress has in other contexts indicated that these privileges are not endless, should the court even consider time?
It's certainly something the court can consider in relation to whether or not, and it's how it relates to the deliberative process.
So you responded when you said you didn't know what the government would say after 50 years or 100 years, but we're at President George Washington's administration, a hypothetical. We don't know what the drafts look like. So hypothetically, the government would say, we will never know what these drafts look like unless there's a waiver.
I suppose that's right. I would just point...
In other words, I'm trying to understand. We have said, the Supreme Court has said, FOIA is a disclosure statute. The
yes.
burden's on the agency. The exemptions are to be narrowly construed.
Correct.
So here we are, 30 years later. The author has long deceased. The events have occurred long ago. And so it's just up to the court to decide 30 years is not long enough?
Based on the record before it. So in this case, you have a disclosure of over 1,000 pages of the first four volumes. In Morley versus the CIA, this court held that you can't engraft onto, in that case, the JFK Assassination Act, you can't engraft that onto the FOIA. So it's a separate statute.
I'm not engrafting. I'm just saying I was careful in asking you the question.
And to acknowledge that
you have distinguished these other statutory schemes. But it is clear, at least Congress had in mind, that despite the very sensitive nature of the communications, there comes a time. And maybe your response simply is, it's for Congress to decide, not the court. That otherwise, this is a privilege that lasts ad infinitum.
I was trying to, yes, I mean, ultimately it is up to Congress to make that change.
And so there is no role for the court in taking into account time.
Well, if the court looks at the agency declarations and says, there's nothing here, and it's been, in Your Honor's example, 200 years since George Washington, there's, based on the record before this court, there's no harm to the deliberative process. Then I think it's something the court could consider. But no, there's no requirement.
If you concede that, that's a concession that you could drive a truck through.
Right.
Because if you concede that the time can diminish the interest, why not 30 years?
And that the court can
do that
on that basis.
I'm merely suggesting that...
You don't want to sound extreme, I understand.
I'm merely suggesting that it's sort of part of...
But
it's
if, you
sort
give
of
up the, if you give up the
analysis.
Hypothetical, you've given up the principle here, I think. The principle being that time can diminish the interest and that the court can make the evaluation of that. So, and the Constitutional Convention was only sealed for 30 years, right? So that's a good historical model on when things can be unsealed.
It's just not, that's fair, Your Honor, but we're not, I think that it's actually the appellant that's sort of going a bit more extreme here. It's basically saying that it's the appellant that's trying to say that the passage of time automatically renders a document reasonable.
I think the appellant is inviting us to exercise our equitable discretion on a case-by-case basis, time limits.
Anything further, counsel?
No, Your Honor. I would just ask that the court affirm the district court's ruling in its entirety.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start with Russell because I think that case undercuts the agency's position in two important respects. First, as Judge Rogers, you pointed out, Russell relied very heavily on the fact that the agency's history was ultimately published, and the court emphasized that the agency would have to stand behind its history in the public forum and likely in litigation as well. And I want to point you to page A39 of the record and Dr. McDonald's declaration, in which he said, quote, "There was never any CIA or history staff plan or commitment to declassify or publish the Bay of Pigs monograph assigned to Dr. Pfeiffer."
Why does that matter?
Your Honor, it might be...
I know you can say that that's what it said, and I take that,
sure.
But I'm just thinking more broadly. Why does it matter that it's made public or not in terms of the decision?
Sure.
In your ultimate legal hook here is there a decision, right?
Right, whether it's pre-decisional.
Mm-hmm.
And what this court has said is an agency decision or policy is something that has real operative effect. Arguably, that's true of a history if the agency publishes that
but
history.
But it can be very true of an agency history that's not published. I think government employees like looking at agency histories regardless of whether the public has looked at the agency history. And so if it's not made public but it's available for staff members future to look at, that's very helpful.
Helpfulness is not the criterion.
I think the public thing has nothing to do with the purpose of the history.
Well,
for purposes of the government decision point.
Your Honor, the helpfulness of the document is not what determines whether it's agency policy. That is whether it has real operative effect or, for instance, determines rights and responsibilities
right.
Either within the agency or outside of it. That could
the
arguably,
decision, right.
And that might arguably be true of something that the agency publishes, but FOIA itself is very averse to secret agency law. And so the fact that the agency never intended to publish it, I think, makes pretty clear that it was never intending to use what Dr. Pfeiffer was doing to set agency policy.
On setting policy, yeah, but if a history is a decision, I know you probably disagree with that, but if a history is a decision for purposes of pre-decisional calculation, mm-hmm. I guess I'm not seeing the public aspect of that necessarily. It's a factor, but I don't think it's a bright line. Oh, it's public, it's a decision, it's not public, it's not a decision.
Right. I think the point in Russell was that a history is an agency decision when it is an official statement in the public that the agency has to stand behind
right.
as an expression of its views.
Okay.
And moreover, the court in Russell did not say, as the agency has said here, that because what was requested was a draft, therefore it automatically qualifies as deliberative.
Right.
What it said is it looked at what was requested were 20 pages that were in the original draft that never made it into the final version. This court looked in camera at those 20 pages and said, if we were to allow release of these 20 pages, someone would be able to reverse engineer the changes, the editorial changes that were made between the original version and the final version.
Can I ask you two other questions
unrelated
if you're finished on that? On chilling effect, isn't it the case that even though you don't have 100% assurance that the superior will protect the process, you have some assurance or some degree of predictive ability about whether this is going to stay confidential, and that heightens the candor that you're willing to express in the document. Wouldn't that be defeated if you don't recognize the deliberative process privilege in court?
2 points, Your Honor. First of all, Judge Rogers asked counsel for the agency, well, what exactly is it? Is it just the mere fact that you've created the document, or is it the decision, the reasons that were given for not accepting it? And he said it's the latter. Mm-hmm. And in this case, all of those reasons have already been made public, and there's nothing more about those reasons that we would learn by disclosure of the draft. Mm-hmm. And second, I think that argument is fatally undercut by the agency's release of Volume 4, which is another draft history that was never finalized. And so it simply cannot be true, as they say, that there is some sort of extreme harm from the release of any draft history at any stage before its finalization.
But isn't the harm, and this goes to, is harm really required in terms of the specific disclosure? Isn't the harm really the breach of the privilege to begin with? As a general proposition, the harm that goes to people working there today.
Right. Your Honor, it's important to point out that if your question is a showing of harm actually required, mm-hmm. the agency has not put forward any basis for treating this as deliberative other than harm, other than their chilling effect argument. Normally, what you have in a case, for instance, like McKinley, is the documents requested there were the basis for the Federal Reserve's
harm's always forward-looking at this moment in time, because you're not going to, the person who did the speaking did it a long time ago. So it's for people working today and tomorrow and the next day at the CIA who know that the protection on which they're counting and at other agencies is no longer going to be as absolute or as, even if not absolute, as strong as they thought it was before, which in turn discourages candor.
Sure. Your Honor, if the sort of blanket assertion that any release of any draft document will cause harm, even if that would otherwise be persuasive, I think in addition to the fact that the document is now 30 years old, we also have the fact that the subject of the document, the Inspector General report, has itself been made public. The fact that the agency does not claim that it intends to publish or finalize any of Dr. Pfeiffer's work. The fact that the circumstances of its rejection have already been made known. And finally, also the fact that the agency has released another draft of Dr. Pfeiffer's work, Volume 4, both in connection with this lawsuit and Dr. Pfeiffer's original suit, without any claim that it's done harm to its deliberative process.
On the time, last question for me. On the time point, or the passage of time point, what about the idea that that's really for Congress to put in a time limit and not for the court to
do? So Congress did put a time limit in the Presidential Records Act and didn't specifically include it in Exemption 5. But Exemption 5 incorporates common law privileges, which themselves take account of time.
In fact, in the Presidential Records Act, actually, you can still assert a number of exemptions even after the 12 years.
It is true, Your Honor.
Not
but,
Exemption 5.
I would point you as well to Nixon versus Freeman, which was a case under the Presidential Communications Privilege, mm-hmm. and that was not under the Presidential Records Act. But the court pointed to the act and said, look, this is a useful analogy, which says that Congress has said even for the president's closest advisors, a 12-year period is presumptively enough.
So should we say 12 years here is enough for deliberative process?
We are certainly not asking for a categorical rule. We think that 30 years, in addition to all of the other circumstances which diminish any possible chilling effect, is more than sufficient, given that they don't claim that there's anything particularly controversial about the subject matter of the document. If there are no further questions, thank you.
We will take the case under advisement.